One is a review handout that's a brief, condensed overview of the minor prophets for those who were not here last time. And the other is a handout on what I learned this morning is the only Italian prophet in the scriptures, Malachi. So these conferences, you learn something every time you come, and it was just, it was an invaluable piece of information I gathered here. So, so again, you have should have two handouts again. One of them, for some of you, will be an old handout that you had before, but I thought, since not everybody was here, I'm going to run quickly through that just to highlight some of the areas of it, and then we'll move on specifically to this particular book. I've had the experience on other occasions where you and another speaker are dividing the same hour. And, you know, theoretically, you've got half an hour and the speaker has half an hour. And you're the second speaker. And so I've sat there and watched the other speaker go from 30 minutes to 35 to 40 to 45, 50, you know, and finally I'm sitting there, you know, and I've got all the points I want to make, and I've got no time. By the end, I've got 5 minutes left to try to get in all my points. Well, this morning, I started with all of my points and all of the time. Now I have all of the time and no points. So, now Mike said he skipped over the little passage there that he had from Malachi, as if that was going to take care of it if he didn't say any more about that specific passage, you know. And he said, you know, I don't want to tread on your ground here. He didn't tread on it. He took his Jaguar and drove from one end of the territory to the other. Then when he finished, he did donuts right in the middle, you know. So. But, in fact, you know, I guess it pays to look, see what else. I knew that Mike was speaking this morning, but I must confess, I knew it was going to be good, so I really hadn't looked that carefully to see exactly what Mike was covering. And I told my wife earlier that I was working on Malachi, and I was working on this and looking ahead and thinking about what I had and all of this, and, you know, 4 hours. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to run 4 hours or not. But on the other hand, none of my students in any of my classes, any places I've ever been, no one has ever complained if we finished a little early. You know, going a little late, yeah, but finishing early, most everybody's fairly happy. In fact, we used to have, there's a speaker who comes to the university that everybody's just ecstatic every time they see he's going to speak in chapel or coming for something, because he never speaks longer than 20 minutes. He has compressed it. He's a 20-minute speaker. That's it. He figures he's got your attention for 20. And you know what? You give him your attention for 20 minutes. So, you know, I figured, okay, everybody might get out a little bit early. So then I heard when Mike was going and saw where he was headed, looked at his outline and some of those things. I leaned over to my wife and said, you know, first that time, maybe 3 hours. And I leaned over and said, well, you know, we're looking at maybe an hour and a half here. So so that's where we are. But I think the Lord will have some things for us. What I think of it really, Mike really did a great job this morning in laying the principles. And when we come to the book of Malachi, what we want to think of this as a case study, in a sense, and a little different approach here, but Mike gave us the principles, and what we have with Malachi is a case study of the wrong side of the principles that he talked about, the problems that he talked about this morning. But let's start, first of all, just looking at the brief overview, and before we get to that, let me just mention some resources. Mike was mentioning some books this morning. Let me mention two or three. I noticed that three of the ones that are on your back page of resources are back on the table back there. The one by Steeds, The Minor Prophets, Their Relevance for Today. And of course, that is something that has so impressed me as I started studying these minor prophets. Indeed, they are relevant for today. It's not something that's just remote and obscure. They are they have a message for now. And then David Lee, Malachi, Messenger of Rebuke and Renewal. That is excellent, inspirational, and you'll find a real blessing in that particular work. And then, of course, Ironside, Minor Prophets. How can you ever go wrong with Ironside? And then R.E. Harlow, The 12 Prophets. So all of those are very good. And I think there were at least three of them that I saw back on the table. There may be more. James Montgomery Boyce. Boyce is good. You just have to be careful with Boyce. He's got some theological positions that we would not completely agree with. But if you work around those, Boyce gives good exposition and good applications and is inspirational along the way. So I enjoy reading Boyce. The book that it was the most helpful and was the one by Kaiser, Malachi, God's Unchanging Love. I thought it was the best balance of scholarship and inspiration. And he gives you excellent exegesis of the passage and what is there, but he also gives you outstanding application and inspiration from the work. So that was just, again, a great blessing. Eugene Merrill, An Exegetical Commentary. Again, very good. It's pretty heavy. I will tell you that the emphasis there is on the exegetical aspects. And it's fairly tedious at times, working through it, but it's solid. And he's good, and he's thorough. Let's just look here for a moment at overview of the Minor Prophets. As I said, this is review. But I do want to hit it for those who weren't here when we started into the Minor Prophets some time ago. But just quickly, the highlights. Prophecy is a window that God has opened for His people by His servants, the prophets. One can see more of God's purposes in His redemptive work than would be possible otherwise. A better understanding of what He had done for and with and through His people in the past. A clearer comprehension of His purpose in the present. It never satisfies insatiable demands for specific details of the future, but it does give a clear view of where God's grace is taking humanity and what obligations, therefore, are laid upon His people. And notice here, meaning of the word prophet and having the idea behind it consistently to proclaim or to announce. I love the second one of those, to flow, boil up, bubble forth, to pour forth words. Not just a pouring forth of words, but a bubbling up from inside of words that God has given. And we're going to find that with Malachi, that's what he does. In fact, the opening words that we start with Malachi, it is the burden that is there. And from that, now that burden that rests upon him that Malachi has to speak. Remember what Jeremiah said. He said, I would like to shut up and not say anything, but the word of God is a fire burning within me, and I've got to proclaim it. I can't shut it up within. So here is the side of that which is boiling up, bubbling forth, pouring forth words, definitely one called by God. Old Testament usage, one who speaks for God. And again, one example there in Exodus 4, particularly, or speaks for another, where Aaron was going to speak for Moses. God says, I'll tell Moses. Moses give the words to Aaron. Aaron can do the speaking for you. So in essence here, the prophet is one who spoke for God. And then you've got a couple of other additional Hebrew words that are related to the prophet as well, meaning to see, and frequently translated as a seer. Also a reference to the prophets sometimes and referring to them as a man of God, hereby emphasizing their holy calling, their moral character, and their divine ministry. And of course, any of us in serving the Lord, that is an essential part, as the calling and the character and that recognizing that what we're doing when we're handling this book, this is God's book, God's Word, and the care that we need to take in handling it and backing it up with a life before God. Notice also the emphasis on as a servant of the Lord, stressing a close and holy relationship between God and His messengers. Prophetic function, a twofold function, both forthtelling and foretelling. And we essentially recognize that the forthtelling aspect is no longer with us. And that we have the sense of prophet today, speaks of it in the New Testament. What we're looking at is a forthtelling, a proclamation of the Word, not a foretelling of future events. There are those around today who would argue for a foretelling prophecies, and that there are those kinds of prophets still around today. I would completely disagree with that. I don't think they have a good biblical basis, but nevertheless, that view is there. Classification, you've got writing or non-writing prophets. And, of course, examples of non-writing prophets, a couple of the outstanding ones in the Old Testament, Elijah and Elisha. And neither of them wrote any books for us to have. But so you've got one or the other. The major or the minor prophets. And very important, the distinction between these two has nothing to do with the caliber of their writing. It has nothing to do with the quality of the message. The only distinction is the length. So it is the major prophets in terms of these books are longer. It is the minor prophets in that they didn't write as much. So that's all. And sometimes we get this notion, we go to the major prophets and we neglect the minor prophets because they're tucked away back in here with a minor, okay, not quite as important. Please, no, 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 not true. And then, looking at the recipient of the message, to whom was the message directed? And here we have to Israel, and those prophets to Israel, to Judah, to Nineveh, Babylon, the exiles, and to Edom. So different groups of people, and it's important to know to whom was the prophet speaking particularly. Chronological periods, we look at three distinct chronological periods here. A pre-exilic period, and you'll see most of the prophets are mentioned there in the period. The prophets during the exile, Daniel and Ezekiel, and then those who are the post-exilic prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And we looked at Haggai last time, and we're going to be looking at Malachi this time. You'll notice here also the various Gentile powers that were ruling at the time when the prophets prophesied. And of course, you'll see here is Persia that was dominating in the period that we're going to be looking at with Malachi. And if you look at the dates, they run all the way from Obadiah in approximately 845 all the way to Malachi in 433. Malachi, the last one to prophesy. And their locations, and Malachi here is the prophet of the restored nation. The impact of the minor prophets. Boy, they dramatize the character of God as few other books do. They highlight God's sovereignty. Indeed, they do more than merely highlight it. They breathe it throughout. I love that statement. They do more than just highlight the sovereign character of God. They breathe it throughout. And you see that in every one of the minor prophets. An awareness of holiness was the driving force behind their sharp denunciations of sin. And we find that again in every one of them. And finally, third, the prophets speak of God's love. Okay. As I said, all of that is review. You've heard that before. You have it there. So let's move on to the book of Malachi. I think, really, if we're going to look at the book of Malachi and we're going to look at the parts of it, the elements of it, I think we need to take the time to begin with to read it. So, if you want to follow along, we're going to read through the entire book. Because I think that really is the only way to get a sense of continuity and a sense of what is here. And then we're going to come back and look at the portions of it. But I want us to see the book as a whole as we begin. It's not, you know, if you really haven't read it, how can you have that all the time in classes, students trying to answer questions of things they haven't read. So, but I'm not going to ask you questions on this, but at least we'll read it through together here. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. I have loved you, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord? Yet I loved Jacob, and I hated Esau, and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down, and they shall call them the border of wickedness, and people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever. And your eyes shall see, and ye shall say, the Lord will be magnified from the border of Israel, or in fact, in some translations, beyond the border of Israel. A son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If then I be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear, saith the Lord of hosts unto you? O priests that despise my name, and ye say, wherein have we despised thy name? Ye offer polluted bread upon mine altar, and ye say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. And if ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee, or accept thy person, saith the Lord of hosts? And now I pray you, beseech God, that he will be gracious unto us. This has been by your means. Will he regard your person, saith the Lord of hosts? Who is there even among you that would shut the doors for naught? Neither do ye kindle fire on my altar for naught. I have no pleasure in you, saith the Lord of hosts, neither will I accept an offering at your hand. For from the rising of the sun, even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. And in every place incense shall be offered in my name, and a pure offering, for my name shall be great among the heathen, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye have profaned it, in that ye say, the table of the Lord is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. Ye said also, behold, what a weariness is it! And ye have snuffed at it, saith the Lord of hosts. And ye brought that which was torn, and the lame, and the sick. Thus ye brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hand, saith the Lord? But cursed be the deceiver, who hath in his flock a male, and voweth and sacrificeth unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith the Lord of hosts, and my name is dreadful of the heathen. And now, O ye priests, this commandment is for you. If ye will not hear, and if ye will not lay it to heart to give glory unto my name, saith the Lord of hosts, I will even send a curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Yea, I have cursed them already, because ye do not lay it to heart. Behold, I will corrupt your seed, and spread dung upon your faces, even the dung of your solemn feasts. One shall take you away with it. And ye shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him of life and peace, and I gave them to him for the fear with which he feared me, and was afraid before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and did turn away many from iniquity. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But ye are departed out of the way. Ye have caused many to stumble at the law. Ye have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore have I also made you contemptible and base before all the people, according as ye have not kept my ways, but have been partial in the law. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously every man against his brother, by profaning the covenant of our fathers? Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel, and in Jerusalem. For Judah hath profaned the holiness of the Lord which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. The Lord will cut off the man that doeth this, the master and the scholar out of the tabernacles of Jacob, and him that offereth an offering unto the Lord of hosts. And this have ye done again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, with crying out, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering any more, or receiveth it with goodwill at your hand. Yet ye say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, yet she is thy companion, and the wife of thy covenant. And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit. And wherefore one? That he might seek godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith, that he hateth putting away. For one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that ye deal not treacherously. Ye have wearied the Lord with your words. Yet ye say, where have we wearied him? When ye say, everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them, oh, where is the God of judgment? Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer to the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. And I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against false swearers and against those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow and the fatherless, and that turn aside the stranger from his right, and fear not me, saith the Lord of hosts. For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. Even from the days of your fathers, ye are gone away from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye said, wherein shall we return? Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts. If I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the fields, saith the Lord of hosts. And all nations shall call you blessed, for ye shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts. Your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, what have we spoken so much against thee? Ye have said, it is vain to serve God. And what profit is it that we have kept his ordinance, and that we have walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts? And now we call the proud happy. Yea, they that work wickedness are set up. Yea, they that tempt God are even delivered. Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it. And the book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them, as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall ye return, and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly, shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. And Malachi lifted his pen, and there was silence. And silence, and silence, and silence, 400 years. Lest I come and smite the earth with a curse, and the Old Testament closes. And for 400 years, there is not another word from God. You ever think about that? I mean, that period of time, it's suddenly all the revelations that have taken place, all of God communicating with the children of Israel, all of this period throughout their history, all of that time, and suddenly we come and Malachi writes, and that is it. Closes. Silence. We were, at Overbrook back at Christmas time, and I was speaking there, and I was going from here and then going, focusing on the appearance of the angel to John, to Zechariah in Matthew, and to, no, not Zechariah, who am I, Yeah, that's right. Okay. And focus on the appearance of the angel, the period of time that came there. So I thought, I wanted to impress, get the idea of the silence that occurs. And so I got up to start speaking. And I read this from Malachi. And then up there, everybody, you know, sitting there in the chapel, I said, excuse me just a moment, I'll be back in a few moments. Just sit quietly. And I got down and walked from the pulpit, walked downstairs. You know, and I just stayed downstairs. My plan was to stay downstairs 4 minutes. 1 minute for each 100 years. But I began to sense that was going to be too long. So then I walked back upstairs after about a couple of minutes, and then walked in. Then I just sat down before getting up to speak, and I waited about another minute. And everybody, it was quiet. It was, you talk about quiet. I mean, even the children were sitting there. They're on Sunday morning. They were sitting, nobody was making a sound. They, you know, all this whole thing. And then I tried to make the point, the silence of how the impact of not saying anything, of not, and wondering what is going on, which is what everybody was doing. What has happened? What is going on? Why isn't he speaking? Why isn't he saying something? And that's what happened after Malachi. That was the whole question. How awkward that was for the children of Israel as they tried to understand what is taking place here. Okay. Let's look then at some of the background of the book of Malachi now that you get a sense. And I hope as you read through the whole continuity of that, and you get a feel for the book, of a sense of, you know, wow, look at what they're doing. And you take what Mike was saying this morning, and what's the response that comes all the way through there? Is a response that we have as well at times that says, who, me? And that's exactly what they're saying. Who, me? No, that doesn't apply to me. You know, so Mike, sorry about all you said this morning. It doesn't apply. Okay. That's it. That's exactly what they're saying. That's their response. Everything that God said to them, they said, who, me? All right, let's look at this. The background, the date. Well, there is no clear date for Malachi. He doesn't give us one in the book. He does not identify any specific events in the book that we can clearly say, this is when this happened. But he does give us some clues. For example, in verse 8, he says, offer it now unto thy governor. He doesn't say, offer it unto the king. Israel was a nation prior to their being carried away into captivity. They had a king. And so now they had a ruling governor. So consequently, his use of the word governor here strongly indicates that probably we're looking at a post-exile period of time. And so if we take the post-exile time as a given from that, then we ask some other questions. Where does it occur during this period? Because they came back around 515 is when the temple is rebuilt. So anywhere just prior to that time and on, where is he along this scale? Well, according to several comments in here, brother, obviously the temple has been rebuilt. So we know that it's later than 515 B.C. because Haggai has already come back, prophesied, and encouraged them to rebuild the temple, and they've rebuilt the temple, and it's completed. So we're past that point of view. Now, once we get past that, then we try to figure out, is there any other period of time that we can locate this? And frankly, the range, there are those in trying to date the book, and the earliest date, some put it in about 480 B.C., so close to the time of the rebuilding of the temple. And the date that we have here is one of the latest dates, and the one that I think probably the most correct date is 433 B.C., because that coincides with Nehemiah's return from when Nehemiah came, then Nehemiah went back, then Nehemiah returned. And if you look at the conditions in Nehemiah, and let's just look at a little bit of that for a moment here. Turn over to Nehemiah. And in Nehemiah chapter 7, okay, here we have then the priests and Levites, the porters and the singers, and some of the people, the Nehathims, and all Israel dwelt in their cities. And the seventh month came, the children of Israel were in their cities. So this is their established there. If we look on over Nehemiah chapter 10, we find something of the conditions here. Okay. And here he talks about a whole gathering together of all of the children of Israel. Boom. That's not what I'm looking for either. I'll tell you where. Come on over to the end. Come over to chapter 13. Okay. Skip on down. Chapter 13 and verse 15. Yeah, this is a better indication. This is what I was looking for. Sorry. In those days saw I in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves and lading asses, and also wine, grapes, and figs, and all manner of birds, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals. And there dwelt men of Tyre there also, which brought fish and all manner of ware, and sold on the Sabbath unto the children of Israel and in Jerusalem. And if you come over to verse 23, in those days also saw I Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. So we find conditions existing here in terms of the keeping of the Sabbath, in terms of intermarriage, in terms of just a lax moral condition that takes place among the children, among those back in Jerusalem, that seems to coincide with this time of the return of Nehemiah, which is why it generally gets put about 433. Now the author, we're told this in verse 1, the burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. Malachi, the word also occurs, you come over to chapter 3 and verse 1, behold, I will send my messenger. That word there, my messenger, is exactly the same word, Malachi. It's the same word that we have in verse 1 of chapter 1. So, in chapter 3, it's translated as, my messenger. In chapter 1, verse 1, it's simply carried through as the term itself, Malachi. So, some would say it's an anonymous book, and it's written by someone, and indeed just the messenger is all it is. And that word Malachi is a title, my messenger. And that's what he is, what it is, and we don't know the name of the other, of the individual. So some argue that, and good people will make that point. On the other end, there's no personal data about Malachi. No other references in Scripture to Malachi. We don't find out anything else about him. All we know about Malachi is that he lived and he wrote. Okay? If he existed. So that's it. If he existed, he lived and he wrote. Now, some are going to say he didn't exist, he was just an anonymous writer, and still inspired, but we don't know who it is. And of course, controversy over who wrote the book of Hebrews. Whether it's Paul, whether it's somebody else, we're not sure who wrote the book of Hebrews. The fact that we're not absolutely positive who wrote it doesn't diminish from the inspiration of the book. So the same case here. And the fact, even if you don't think Malachi was an individual per se, it doesn't diminish the authenticity and the authority of this particular book. However, I think that there was a Malachi. I think he did live. I think he was an individual. There's good evidence that is out there, particularly linguistic evidence, that they will argue, was the word, can the word be used as a personal noun, as a name? And there's good evidence that it grammatically can be. I'm not going to get into that because I don't understand all the arguments myself. It gets into Hebrew grammar. But I understand what the people who are studying it talking about. So there are linguistic elements that support it. The theme, as we read through the book, the clear message is a call for repentance and renewal on the part of the children of Israel. And I'm going to read this section here from Merrill because I think it really captures the whole nature of the book. The Malachi appeared on the scene at a time when the euphoria of the post-exilic Jewish community, following the rebuilding of the temple and the restoration of social and political life, was beginning to give way to cynicism in both the sacred and secular arenas. I have that underlined on my page, a giving away to cynicism in both the sacred and secular. The priests had begun to become corrupt in their official capacities, as well as in their private lives. The people had mingled themselves with the pagans around them by undertaking illicit marriages and pandering to false religious systems. And the nation as a whole had lost the ardor of messianic eschatological hope, focusing its attention on the mundane necessities and pleasures of the here and now. Does that track back to anything that was said this morning? Malachi's message was one of rebuke and indictment of each of these ills and across the social spectrum. A message that ended, however, with a note of ultimate hope. To me, two things jump out of that paragraph. The line that I said, I have underlined, cynicism in both sacred and secular arenas, and focusing attention on the mundane necessities and pleasures of the here and now. But obviously, this was for that time, a long time ago, so there's no relevance. I mean, it's like today's newspaper, isn't it? I mean, it's what we're seeing every day. That's the theme of Malachi, that focus on the here and now in a cynical spirit. We find it in our world around us, and we find it within the church itself, unfortunately. So, this is the theme, the thrust. I love Ironside says the basic thrust is turning away in their hearts while outwardly professing to serve God. Turning away with their hearts while outwardly professing to serve God. Boy, anybody seen anything like that? Of course not. Boy, I mean, that's what is going on right now. That's what is going on around across the country. There's a whole surge, a sense of religiosity, if you want. Going through emotions, pretending at Christianity, but without any reality behind it. And that's exactly the problem in Malachi. The structure of the book, as you notice as we read through, it is largely a dialogue between God and Israel, back and forth. Second statement, takes the form of a controversy or a debate. Okay? In other words, God makes a charge. Their response is, are you kidding, God? You know, no, no way. That's not true. That's not right. And God says, okay, let me give you the evidence. And so God points out the specifics. And so it's a beautiful kind of a controversy back and forth. What is amazing is the absolute, utter audacity of them to respond to God in the way they do when God says, look at you, and makes the charge, and they say, no, 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 not true, God. Wow. You know? But we do it sometimes in just a little more subtle way. They were pretty blatant with it. But it's a controversy back and forth between God and the children of Israel. The organization of the book, I wrestled I don't know how long. I thought it was going to be easy. I really did, because the first thing, when you read through, what's the first thing that jumps out at you? The wherein, 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 wherein have we done this? How have we done that? And I thought, oh, okay, that just leaps right off of there. There we go, structure for it. And the more you read, and you look at different people, and you'll notice here, I've got it laid out for you. And I'm not sure my final answer, I think, was a compromise of all three. But you have Merrill and Jim Catron. I don't think I put his on the resources. I should have. That's Jim Catron and his book from Emmaus that's excellent on this. Summary of the synopsis, if you want, of all the minor prophets. And just an excellent little book. And I don't think I put that on the resource list. But Merrill and Catron tend to focus on God's charges. And so they look at a larger picture. Here's what God's charge rather than the response of the people. So they break it into really six parts throughout the book. Then you look at Boyce, and where the word that we have translated into King James, which is wherein, or where did we do that, in the Hebrew or in other translations, and in fact in the NIV I note here, is generally translated as how. How did we do that? How did that occur? How has that taken place? And so Boyce tends to focus on that word how. And he goes through and organizes his entire structure around their response to the word how. On the other hand, Ironside and Harlow identify eight challenges to God's authority. And he takes it on the phrase, ye say. So wherever God says, ye say, then he looks at that as a separate division. So it was Do we find six divisions in here? Are there seven divisions? Or are there eight divisions? And you can kind of pay your money and take your choice. It's not really all that critical which one you're going to take. I think you still get the essence of the book. And I've broken down the differences here with each one of those. And what happens in some of them, you'll notice here that the main problems are, for example, in chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, where we have at the end of verse 6, O priests that despise my name, and ye say, wherein have we despised thy name? Ye offer polluted bread upon my altar, and ye say, wherein have we polluted thee? Now, verses 6 and 7, should that be taken together as one unit? Or are those indeed separate segments of despising the Lord's name, and wherein have we despised your name? And over here you've polluted my altar, wherein have we polluted your altar? So are those two separate, distinct divisions, or do we put both of those together in terms of their questioning God, in terms of overall pollution of the offerings and pollution of the altar? So how do we put it together there? And then, of course, what do we do with chapter 4? And where it deals with the day, and the day of the Lord particularly here. So some, in fact most, connect that in with chapter 3 and see it as a continuity of this of the Lord's response to them that continues on from chapter 3 right on through a good part of chapter 4. Others, on the other hand, separate chapter 4 completely and make that simply a conclusion to the book. So I think I did kind of part of one, part of the other. Part of chapter 4 in with chapter 3, and then the last part of it as the conclusion there. So, as I say, those are ways in which I think the book is organized. What really becomes a key striking feature, you're looking at God's charges and Israel's responses. And that's what really ties the book together and provides focal points for the study of the book of Malachi. I'm not sure. Where are we on time? I don't know whether I want to jump in the next part or take a break here. About 9 minutes. Let's take a break here. Everybody's looking a little foggy-eyed. This is a break. Jumping.